You know, these are the people in Vegas.
This is the early crowd.
People who are like, I am going to get my return on investment for this training.
No matter what.
No matter what. Anyway, this is a live recording of the One Thing podcast. We have our special guest, Cody Sanchez, that we'll get to in a moment. Yes. And I want to really quickly mention, this is all also possible because one of our sponsors. So Riz Media Premier offers exclusive information and insights necessary to achieve unparalleled success in real estate. All Keller Williams attendees receive $100 off their first annual membership when they go to rizmedia.com/premier and use the coupon code RISFR24. So thank you, Riz Media, for making this whole thing possible. Now, our regular host, Nikki Miller. We get to do this live. We've never done this.
We don't get to do that many together. This is really cool.
Yeah.
And a very special occasion because we have a very special someone with us.
So if you don't know Cody Sanchez, gosh, we're going to go through a lot of this in your story, but you started as a journalist. You grew up in an immigrant family. So didn't come from a lot, but you chose hard again and again. Journalism in Juarez covering crime. Which is, I can't think of a tougher place outside of a war zone. You then went head on into the world of finance, which also puts up plenty of barriers to make sure that the gilded walls, the people who are already behind them are safe, but you learned the language of finance, and eventually you took that and tried to democratize it so that everybody could be owners. And that's really why we're here. I first heard your message about buying boring businesses, and to me, that's just like, I want to buy cash flow. I want to buy income. I'm not going to play the asset valuation game or because I get that in my stocks already. I want income because income is what drives my lifestyle. So anyway, Nikki, do you have anything to add to that or are we just going to dive right in?
I think we're going to dive right in, but I'll start if that's okay with
please,
you.
Please.
We were chatting backstage and we have an interestingly similar background. I started in journalism too. And it's funny because I probably get the look that you get a lot when people are like, how do you go from journalism to business and finance? And I would offer that it was some of the most important training that I ever got. And it's part of what has made me and will make me successful. And I'd love your perspective on that, because I'm sure you get this question. And I'd love to learn what you took away from it.
The most important part of being a good investor and making a lot of money is not losing it, right? Warren Buffett's first rule is... the first rule of investing is never lose money. The second rule is never forget rule number one. And so the wonderful part about investing is if you don't want to lose money, how do you actually do that? Well, it's really just about not being at an information disadvantage where you don't actually know what's happening in the thing you're going to invest in. And how do you not be at an information disadvantage? You ask good questions. What is journalism? But continual question, asking and answering. And so I think the thing that translates from journalism, from sales to investing and making money is simply, can you ask a lot of questions? Can you be very comfortable with the idea that you are in fact not the smartest person in the room, but probably the one who knows the least? And if you can do that again and again continuously, it turns out you can make some money.
Well, I think you said something yesterday in the interview, the smartest people are the ones who don't care if they look dumb. And the dumbest people are trying to look smart. And so just asking the obvious dumb question again and again. Explain it to me like I'm an 11-year-old, whatever that is. Get your ego out of the way and you'll make a better investment.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that stops most people from succeeding is fear, right? And typically it's fear of inaction, but the second worst type of fear is fear of acting. And so you make an action that is actually really dumb because you wanted to seem smart, because you wanted somebody to like you, because you weren't comfortable pushing back. And so in investing, if you think about it this way, what's your job as an investor? I see, I don't know, 2,000, 3,000 deals a year just in our venture capital fund. So we have people that screen 2,000 or 3,000 deals. Then when they finally get to me, maybe we do, I don't know, 60 to 200 deals we see that we do a decent amount of due diligence on a year. So what am I actually as an investor? I'm a captain no. No, 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 no thanks, not today, not gonna be me, find somebody else. And because of that, I have to get really comfortable with this fear around other people want me to do this, other people aren't gonna like me. And that I think is really key to becoming an incredible investor.
If think so many people, I mean, I watch this in real estate and I've seen it a little bit on the private equity side. I think when we formed Keller Capital, Mitch, who was running Point for us, an analyst, we looked at 441 deals before we pulled the trigger. And we just got really smart on saying no. But a lot of people, they spend all this time pulling together their capital, either to make a down payment on an investment property or like, I'm gonna get into this business acquisition game. And then they're just like, all this investment up front, now they wanna take action. They just get over their skis so fast. But I love what you just said. That's why I wanna underscore it. If you said no 999 times, your one yes would have such a better chance of success. Because all the no's make you super smart.
Yeah. It's so true. I mean, you know, there's another famous quote from Munger where he basically says, my no's never keep me up at night, but my yeses do. Which, you know, if any of you have run a business, you know how that feels. You have never lost sleep over something that you didn't invest in or decide to run. You do lose sleep over the things that you say yes to. And so I try to remember that when I'm getting really excited in the beginning. It's sort of like dating. How many people do you date before you get married? Quite a few. Turns out you should do the same thing in your career or in any of your investments. And that's actually perfectly fine. Captain No, totally fine.
Captain No. Can I just say, I mean, God bless you, Charlie Munger, wherever you are. Passed away at the end of the year. That guy had more quotes worth remembering.
Oh, yeah.
And they were often funny.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite ones from him was, I'd rather put a biper down my shirt front than hire a management consultant. I kind of can relate to that, if you guys have ever handled
it. You've read his book, right? Charlie Munger's Almanac?
Yeah.
It's one of the best reads I've ever.
Yeah, short, brief. With a lot of common sense.
Yeah, with a lot of common sense. Well, speaking of, I think that's really what you're talking about. And I think one of my favorite things about your messaging is that I think people get really intimidated about the world of business and the world of finance, and especially the world of buying businesses, because they think it's this big monster. And the people who do it frequently, who they don't want other people in it, they're like, oh yes, this is very complicated. Very, very complicated. Big words, lots of math you wouldn't understand. Mm-hmm. And your position is, it's actually not that complicated. You just have to know the rules. And you've really built your career teaching people the rules in a simple way that they can digest. What are some of your favorite rules? Like, what are some of the most important that you never infringe on?
That those who say it's impossible should get out of the way of those doing it. That, you know, we do the dirty work, even especially when we don't want to. We have something called the Contrarian Creed, which are 13 rules that my companies, all of them, from the investment firms all the way to the media companies, live by. And we have 13 because we don't believe in luck. We make it, right? And so on purpose, everything we do at the company is pretty thoughtful in that way. And so if you were to come to our studio and our office, you'd see that everything that was inside is made in America. You know, you'd see a newspaper that was the first day that we sent the first newsletter out at Contrarian Thinking Capital on the wall. You know, you would see a picture of my grandfather, who was a justice of the peace and a federal magistrate, which is a judge, because I think you should tell the truth because it's easier to remember. And so these like little small things are Easter eggs that drive your company culture, and your company culture is really what drives your success. And so, you know, what I've found again and again is they're not just rules for you to set and forget. Like every single Monday, we have a call. It's called the Weekly Compass at my companies, and everybody gets on the call, and I give a 10 to 15 minute spiel. And it's very thoughtful. We pick one of the 13 member rules from the creed, and we tell a story about it. So for instance, that we do the dirty work. I was at Andy Frisella's headquarters, a guy who runs a company called First Forum, incredible company. I'm a huge fan, and he's become a friend. And I was in the bathroom, and I was like putting on lipstick or something. And somebody came by, and they washed their hands, normal, grabbed a paper towel, dried their hands, normal, and then cleaned the sink. And then cleaned the countertop and then threw it away. And I thought, that's a nice person, okay. Then another person comes in, cleans their hand, cleans the sink, cleans the countertop. And I stop them. I'm like, what the fuck's going on here? Like, this is not a normal behavior. What are you doing? And she kind of looked at me affronted. I probably didn't use the F word, but she looked at me affronted and said something like, how you do anything is how you do everything, right? And then walks out. And I was like, oh. We have so much work to do at my company because my employees would still never say that. And he has imbued in his company this sense of culture that is the most empowering thing that I've ever seen. Like, what if you actually believed that? What if you actually believed that how you do anything is how you do everything? Then you would probably be fitter. You'd probably be happier. You'd probably be more intentional. You would be more thoughtful. And
you
I can't do
a lot less things.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. It's like, if I was really trying to be intentional about everything, I'm doing a lot less things.
Maybe just one thing?
Yeah, yeah. That's more my style. But like, I want to highlight that. Like, what you're doing, actually, I think it's the formula. So Keller Williams has, we call it our belief system. Mm. But if we talk about what that means, it's the rules that we agree to live by. How we're going to, like, the rules. And it's the Y4C2T, so we got 9 of them. Yep. We made a very awkward acronym, which we're very good at. But, like, when we kick off meetings, it's just something like that. A lot of times in our corporate, for 24 years now, we'll kick off a meeting, and we'll try to highlight just one. Mm-hmm. And it's exposure over time. And when a leader does that in front of someone and then says, that's the value or that's the rule, over time, the people that are attracted to those things are the ones that stick. And the people who just want to leave a messy sink, they bow out. So, like, it's not complicated. It's just a long process to build that culture purposefully and from what I've seen. So, like, I just want to, one, I applaud you for doing it. You're trying to get the DNA of your culture
right.
Nailed.
Right.
And that will tell you who in the future is attracted to it, because that's what they want.
Yep.
I want to work with people where the little details matter.
Yep.
I want to work with people that have these sort, we're going to take action, do the dirty work. Like, the people who get excited about that, they're running to your door.
Yeah.
Well, it's John Wooden teaching people to put on their socks. And I know in Andy's training, he teaches yeah. people the appropriate way to sweep their warehouse floor, even if yeah. that's not what they do,
yep.
right? It's all similar. It's them saying that if you can't do these foundational things right, you absolutely don't earn the right to do anything else. And what I find is that any company who has these credences, has these rules that they create, it's usually, I often say that any company is built in the founder's image.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how big it gets. Every company is built in the founder's image. And I would bet that it's probably your image that you've built it in the sense that these are the things you've learned along the way as you have built and as you've failed, right? And I'd love to ask a longtime mentor of mine also used to always say to me, he would say, Nikki, there's no skill called business. So like you can get out of going to business classes and you can stop reading the business magazines. And I only will allow you to read business books of people who have wrote them who actually built businesses. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to hear how you've learned along the way because you had an unconventional path mm-hmm. and I think probably were in a traditional business setting and then picked your head up one day and said, this isn't right. This is not for me.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, first, I think what I'd want to say is anytime somebody used to talk about company culture, I was like, ugh, who cares? Like, I work in a company.
It's
I work
scary.
By myself. Yeah. It may, like, gross and, like, must be nice. The second that I have millions of dollars in revenue and lots of employees, I'll bother with that nonsense, creed, whatever. And then I realized that, to your point, company culture is just you magnified.
Yeah.
And so Jordan Peterson says, clean up your room before you clean up the world, right? And it's the same exact thing. So if I have a creed that I live by, I will become a better human. And then as I add people into my circle, because I know that success is contagious, by the way, so is failure, I'm going to make sure those other people have the same creed because I don't want to have to drag somebody along. I want us to be pushing together. And so I think it's really important, even if you guys don't manage a company or manage a team, write one for yourself. Like, can you imagine what it would be like if I was interviewing somebody and I said, you know, tell me about you. What are you most proud of in your career? And they're like, well, I have a personal creed that I live by. And this is what the creed is. And this is how I work. And this is how I think about things. And this is the type of human I am. I'd be like, that guy.
Yeah.
Success.
And well, it takes the guesswork out of things, doesn't it? Like, I don't have to think about what I should do in this situation. I can just refer back to this way I've already decided I'm going to behave in the world.
100%. And, like, being really thoughtful in your responses to the world. You know, my husband has this saying, which is that words mean things. And we kind of say it tongue in cheek because often I think people don't actually understand the definition of the words that they use. And that's really dangerous because when you, at my company, you know, Tanner's here, he'll tell you, at my company, if somebody comes up to me and I say, hey, I want to get this done, and they say, well, I don't think that's possible. I go, excuse me? It's not what I asked you. I said, I want to get this done. How could we?
Mm-hmm.
And now you could say, Well, it would take a lot of money to do that. Well, the time frame might be longer. Well, we might need additional resources. Well, I don't really understand how to do this. Appropriate response. And so what if you did that same thing to yourself? You know, what if in the mirror you were like, I want to make $1 million this year. And your little voice inside of your head goes, that's impossible. And you go, excuse me, I didn't ask you if it was possible. I said, I want this to happen. What do I have to do to make that happen? And that like slight flip of the switch can change your life. And I think that's a lot of what Tony Robbins and some of the people here this week help people do. And then you need to take that back somehow. And so that's why I like some of the tactics. Now, when it comes to learning, I'm lazy. I want to do the least amount of work and have the highest ROI on the work. And because I also work a lot, if I do that continuously, the compounding is incredible, right? And so when I think about how to learn, I am always looking for a who, not a how. You know, we have a friend that wrote a book, Dan Sullivan, called Who, Not How. Incredible book, also summarized in one sentence. Every time you have a problem, you don't actually have a how problem, you have a who problem. Go and find the person that can solve the problem for you instead. So
great
I don't just-
shortcut. It's right, a great shortcut. You could read 20 books and not be as knowledgeable as 1 hour spent with someone who's read 100. Yep. So go find the professor, go find the nerd that spent their life figuring out that thing and just talk to them and ask thoughtful questions. You're like a super shortcut to getting smart.
Yes.
You're also only as good as what you do with it too. And we know tons of people who are very well read and have absolutely done nothing with it.
Yeah. You know, I think that's again why the who is so important, because A players, rock stars, do not hang out with B players or C players. We just won't allow that in our orbit continuously. And so if you are somebody who comes to me, asks for advice, doesn't do the advice, the second time, you get one more time, and the third time I go, looks like you got a personal problem. Come back to me when you want to take action. And that's what players do. So if you also want to hyperspeed your ability to change, get on high-performing teams, because winners love pressure, and they love other people who love pressure, and they will not tolerate underperformers.
So what's the stat? You've given it on social. You gave it with Gary in your interview yesterday. So if I'm sitting next to a high performer, in this case, two, my performance goes up by 15%. But if it's a low performer, we'll pretend like someone's over here.
I was going to say, do not point this direction.
No, I'm going out there. Like, then my performance actually drops by twice that much.
By 30%.
And sitting by is within 25 feet.
Yeah. Well, and put it in dollar amounts, because that might be like, okay, I don't know, 15%, what even is performance? So if I think about it like money, I make $100,000 a year right now. You make $100,000 a year right now. Great. You sit next to Jay, who is a high performer. Jay could help you increase your ability to perform by 15%. So now you make $115,000 a year. You actually are no better, no smarter, no different. You are just in a circle of orbit of the high performer. And then we have Terry next to me. And Terry is an underperformer. And Terry takes me from $100,000 to what? $70,000 a year. I'm no better, I'm no worse, I'm no more capable or less capable. I just sat next to Terry and I allowed him in my orbit. And if we think about it that way, the universe doesn't like you to talk about this. Actually, the universe does, society does not like you to talk about this, because what do they say? What are you gonna do? Leave all your friends? You're just gonna leave everybody behind? You're just gonna not hang out with a bunch of people? You holier than thou? And it's like, you know what? Yeah, get on my level or get out. And the other thing about that is like, that's okay.
Yeah.
Like, it is so...
Absolutely okay.
Because how many times have you had somebody tell you something? You're not good enough. You're not going to make it. You're not a high enough performer for me. And you have two options. You can either go cry about it, or you can use it as a chip on your shoulder that becomes a little bit of fuel.
Yeah. One of our principles, you know, span of control, right? This idea.
Yeah.
You don't have to have everybody that you're in your circle with is awesome, but if you have five. And it's the old Jim Rohn quote, you know, you're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. Like, I want to do a study and prove that.
Yeah.
Because if you can spend really purposeful time with four or five high performers, I just feel like it puts you on a whole different trajectory. As a business owner, what it means is I don't have to have 100, but if the five that report to me are exceptional, chances are they're only going to allow exceptional people to report to them, and then it cascades to the organization. But that one C player, that one B player, it can start to kind of infest your whole organization.
Well, I think what's really important about that, too, is that everything normalizes. So when you're with people who are leveled up, and they're if you're the one doing $1 million a year in revenue, and all of a sudden you're around five people who are doing $1 billion a year in revenue, you're like, oh, I can do that. Like, that's a thing. And then it just normalizes. And all of a sudden you find yourself there. And then you get to the next group who's doing even more. And it just all normalizes over time. Is that what you've seen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have a mentor and an investor of mine. His name is Bill Perkins. He wrote the book Die with Zero. And Bill's like pretty much a billionaire. He gives away a lot of money. So I don't know what the exact dollar amount is. But Bill, I remember one day we're walking at his compound. It's like this huge house in Austin, $26 million, overlooking the lake.
I don't think you said his compound, not his house. It's you're not walking his compound.
Multiple houses. It's ludicrous. And he's like, you want to have the meeting in the library or the boat? I'm like, this is so silly. And so anyway, I'm walking with Bill and I'm telling him my ideas for the next year. And I think that my ideas are kind of big. I'm like kind of proud of these ideas. And Bill looks at me and he goes, huh. Do you think that being around small business for so long has made small infect your thinking? I was just like, excuse me. You know? Yeah, and then instead of getting mad about it, I sat with it. I said, I don't know the answer to that. Let me think about it. And I remember I came back to him, you know, probably like a month later, and I said, maybe, yeah, what about this? And it was a $1 billion idea, not a $100 million idea. And I don't know if we'll hit it, but man, if I shoot for a $1 billion idea with the same amount of intensity and effort that I typically do, as opposed to a $100 million idea, I'm probably more likely to hit the $100 million idea on the way. And so I do think being around those, if you get a chance, everybody these days, isn't it weird what society tells you that isn't real? Like the internet says, like, this billionaire is so rich and greedy and terrible. And so, you know, the rich are awful. Right? These people are taking all your money. And actually, it's the opposite of that. It's like if you get around really, really rich people, they level you up. Mm-hmm. So what we shouldn't be doing is trying to, you know, shame them. We should be saying, just like, hang out with normal people more. Hang out with the rest of us because success is contagious. And just by being in this room today, you guys might have that reciprocal effect.
I've got a Cody quote that I carry around. So you have to tell me if I got it right.
Ooh.
But you need to hang out with people who for whom your dreams are just another Tuesday.
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah.
And I just think that's just a great principle, right? Because it'll normalize it. For them, six-pack abs, that's just what we do. That's how we eat. That's how we conduct our lives. And it is infectious. And we would want that for our kids.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it matters who they hang out with. We just don't take our own advice.
Yeah. I mean, do you guys all have those friends where when you go out to dinner with them, you just know you're going to have like a bottle and a half of wine. And like the next morning's gonna be a little slow. It'll be a great dinner. Like, but you just know that that's coming and it's normalized. So you go and you're like, I'm gonna have 4 to 5 glasses or, oh, they're always gonna do shots because it's crazy Sam and Sam's always doing shots. Okay, fine. But the opposite of that is true. Like I went to dinner last night with my friend Gabrielle Lyon. She doesn't drink. It might be weird if I had a bottle and a half of wine with my friend Gabrielle who doesn't drink. Gabrielle also has a 6-pack. So if I ended up ordering bread and dessert and she doesn't order bread and dessert, it's also a little weird. So are 6-packs contagious? Maybe. It's just how you think about your actions and what happens when they're around a group of people that do something different than you.
I think what's really important to highlight about the story that you were telling about your mentor too is your humility in that. Because I think a lot of time when people get around successful people, they want to prove that they should be at the table. I'm just going to talk and tell you how great I am so that I can prove to you that I deserve to be here. And he asked you a question, and a lot of people I think would hear that and want to have an answer. And they would say without thinking whatever they, you know, whatever first came to mind. And you gave a really thoughtful answer, which was, let me actually think about that. And then it takes a lot of humility to go back and sit on it and say, you might be right. Maybe I'm not thinking the way I could be. And I think that's a really important highlight to that story that you told, because I think that you have to get around those people and then you have to have the humility to learn and to know that they probably have the humility to learn from you. Like we all have something we can learn from each other, and yet you don't need to prove that you earn the right to be there. You just show up.
Yeah. Feedback from winners is a gift. Feedback from people who haven't done it before isn't necessary. So I think, you know, hugely underrated hack, don't take advice from people who haven't done the thing that they're trying to give you advice on. And yet, all over the place, you have your mom going, well, you know, you should just go back and get that job. You're like, Mom, you haven't worked in 35 years. So why don't you, I love you, not the advice I'm trying to take. You know, Dad, you should go and you should just keep working here and you should continue to do it nonstop until you're 65 and retired. Why? I want to make millions. You haven't made millions yet. And so, like, you could still love somebody and think that their advice in a certain area is not relevant. You know, if I want to be a better mother or a better father, nobody I'd rather go to my parents. If I want to make billions of dollars, it's probably not going to be them. And, like, if we could just be honest about that and not make that some emotional appeal to us or that makes them worse in some way, if you flip it around, sometimes my husband does this thing that's ridiculous. He'll go, I just want to repeat back to you what you said. And so he'll repeat back to me a thing, and then he'll go, did that sound as ridiculous coming out of my mouth as it is yours? And I'll go, fuck, kind of did. And so when you repeat back some of these words.
My wife is hearing you say this right now. I can guarantee in my future.
Well, if you are somebody who is already self-confident, you already know your worth. When somebody says something like that to you, you're going to go, oh, actually, that didn't sound kind
of ridiculous. All right.
Thanks. It's not that I'm ridiculous, but that did.
Yeah. For sure. I'd love to know, we obviously have a lot of real estate agents in the room, and one of the pieces of advice I want them to hear from you is something you and I talked about backstage, and I was sharing that I see the real estate trap in our world is that these agents go out and they work a lifetime, decades, to build these enormous businesses, and then they sort of hit the pinnacle of success. They've built these huge businesses, and they're extremely successful by the terms of real estate, and then they're stuck because they're just strapped with this big monster business. And they don't know how to get rid of it. They don't know how to sell it. They don't know how to hand it off. They don't know what to do with it. And then they feel stuck because then they become a slave to the business. And I'd love to get your perspective on this. What would be your advice to them?
I suppose it depends if they want... most things that you want out of life are a problem of you not actually knowing what you want. And so I talk a lot about... You guys remember in The Matrix, you know, Morpheus and Neo are walking down a street in The Matrix, and Neo gets distracted by this beautiful woman in a red dress, and then the agent kind of is, like, immediately in front of his face, gonna kill him. And Morpheus tells him, like, you know, you have to watch out for the woman in the red dress. And the woman in the red dress in life is just everything. It's every shiny object that it surrounds us. And so what I would say for most people is, you have to know what you really want. If what you want is to no longer work, and you want to take a big lump sum of money from the business, or you want to have an annuitized stream of revenue from the business, or you just want to work less in the business, or you actually just want to do this one part, you love sales, but can somebody handle all the operations in the business for me? Like, there's lots of different recipes depending on the type of cake you want to bake, right? And so I think step number one is actually, what do you want? Now, what do you really want? Now, can you get so crystal clear with it that the second that you say it, somebody knows almost somebody who they could recommend to you on it? Mm-hmm. Because I go back to that idea of who, not how. If you want to sell your real estate business and you want a lump sum money right now today and you want to be done in the next 6 months because you want to retire with your kids, your grandkids in South Florida, okay. Then you start to figure out who could be my who. Well, man, I got this number two, actually, that's like young at the firm. He's a total hustler, and he makes good money. I bet he could buy my business out for some amount right now today. And so I think the question is, get really clear and then find your who.
What goes through my head is getting really clear about who I want to be in the future is easy to say and tough to do.
Yeah.
Like, I'll be honest. I can't predict how I'll feel after my buffet that I'm going to eat at 7 p.m. tonight or whatever.
I can't.
I'll go in, I'll be like, oh, that's going to be great. And then I'll be moaning, like, why did I do this to myself on the backside? We do that a lot.
Yeah.
But I think that every scenario was really great. I mean, your acumen, you just laid out every scenario in our exit real estate class.
Mm.
Nailed it, right? You can finance the business. You can take a role and partner with someone. Like, we've got names for all of them. And my advice would be, if that's you, all of those people are here at this event. They're in your market center. They're in the offices. Just go spend a day with one of them.
Yeah.
Like, predicting it is one thing. Go look and see, like, you know what? If Andy likes that or Darla likes that, maybe I would too. Chances are you would.
Yeah,
I think we all think we're a lot more unique than we are.
Yeah.
But just go visit with someone who's already doing that. And if it appeals to you, it's probably going to be okay. Don't overthink that part.
That's so true. Because most often what I hear from business owners that want to sell or transition out of their jobs or whatever, it's like, I know that worked for them, but that's not gonna work for me. Like, my situation's different. And after you've seen so many of them, you're like, no, it's not. I mean, if you guys are parents, how many times have you had your kid come to you and they're like, my heart's broken? You're like, you're 12, Tina. Like, your heart isn't broken, you're gonna be fine. There's gonna be 42 more of these.
Yeah.
But, you know, the only way you realize that is through experience, right? And so one thing, if I could leave you with one piece of advice, it's first of all, if you have a real estate business today, please do me a solid and never just walk away. Like, never, ever. Can I tell you the number of small business owners that never sell or transition their business because they think it's too hard, they think it's not possible, and they wait a little bit too long? We actually have a company called BizScout.io. You can get on the wait list. It's not live yet, but we're positioning to be a marketplace for small businesses to be bought and sold in a bunch of non-traditional ways. Because if you think about it, imagine you own a house, right? And this house is like not the nicest house. You know, it's kind of like a beat up house. You got a tenant in there. They pay you some money, but like it's not a ton of money. You're kind of annoyed with the property. So what do you do naturally? You burn it down and you just, you know, you do nothing with the land. That seems like a good idea, right? Nobody would ever do that in real estate. And yet in small businesses, people burn down their business every single day and they just walk away. But you have some value from what you've created. Your client list, your back-end ops, your marketing, your social media channels. Like, do me a solid, and anytime you're thinking of closing down even a side hustle, see if you can sell it. Because there is some value there that somebody else doesn't have to create.
It's a huge blind spot for business owners.
Yeah.
And we teach people to track their net worth. And my wife observed this. She's working with all these women who run these huge businesses, and the number one thing that they didn't list on their net worth was their own business.
Well,
and we're working in it, so it's hard to think of this thing that we go to work in, our own business every day, is actually an asset that has some value, but that's kind of where it starts. Until the very end, they're not even thinking of it as an asset, and therefore, like your house, you walk in, if it needs a new roof, you put a new roof on it.
Right.
Because it's an asset. And if we're not thinking of our business as an asset, we're probably not maintaining it in such a way that someone's going to want to live in it after us.
I think that
one habit that my wife and I are really proud of that we put in place over the last couple of years is a monthly budget review. Getting on the same page about how we're investing and spending has been a game changer for us. Whether you're budgeting by yourself or you're financial planning with another, it can be tedious. You're pulling together multiple sources of information, updating multiple spreadsheets. But the good news is it doesn't have to be that difficult. That's why I want to recommend Monarch Money. Monarch is a top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. With Monarch, you can create custom budgets, track progress towards financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/onething. What I like about Monarch, it's intuitive. Unlike other apps that I've used in the past, it's simple. The intuitive design makes it easy to set up and customize. It allows for collaboration, so you can collaborate with your partner, family, financial advisor. It's customizable, it's customer-focused, and it's ad-free. After trying out Monarch myself, I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And now, listeners of this podcast will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/onething. That's monarchmoney.com/onething for your extended 30-day free trial.
It's the most important part, that if we do perceive it that way, that we start behaving as if it is our business. We start treating it like a business. We operate it like a business. We hold it accountable like a business. And that's something I really love from your talk at the CEO Summit yesterday, which is that you don't buy aspirations, you buy reality, right? And real profits. What are some of the things that you're looking for when you're acquiring businesses that you know this is something that you would want to acquire? Like, what are your determining factors of the health of the business?
Yeah. Well, first, actions beat feelings and thoughts every day of the week, right? So instead of you just feeling differently about your business, try this. Go and make sure that you have a normalized P&L, so like a profit and loss statement that you have updated for that year, and you have your historical tax returns for your business. Make an appointment with your banker and schedule a 30-minute appointment for you to sit down with them and say, here's my business. What do you need in order for me to get a line of credit on this business? What does that do? It immediately puts a valuation on your business. So just like a house, you go, yeah, that house is worth about $275K, Zillow says. You go, oh, my business that makes $300,000 a year in profit is actually worth $900,000 in a line of credit from a bank. That's probably not going to be the actual ratio, but moral of the story, you're going to have an amount the bank will be willing to actually lend you money on, which is fascinating, and so few business owners do this. Doesn't mean you have to take the money, but then you have this first level of valuation. Then I think if you have a business that's doing more than $1 million, but definitely more than $5 or $10 million a year, you should get a third-party valuation on your business. And you should say, I mean, it's going to cost you a couple $1,000s, like de minimis in the long run. But if you have clean financials, you have a P&L, and you have historical tax returns, you can take this to a third party and say, what is this business worth on the street? And they might say, hey, it would be really hard to sell for this list of 15 reasons why, but theoretically, you could sell this business for this. And so if you have an action as opposed to a feeling, you're going to treat your business differently. So I would start there. And then the second part of, wait, tell me your question one more time.
What are the things that you're looking at when you're looking at buying a business that tell you what the health of the business is?
Keep it stupid simple, the KISS statement, which is basically, I don't buy turnarounds, I don't buy other people's problems. And when I say that, it's definitely for anybody who's buying a business for the first time. How many of you guys have bought a house, you want to flip it, you go and do construction on the house, you design it, whatever, and the house is done under budget and faster than you thought? Huh. Zero. No, yes. It's echoes in here. The same is true for a small business. So if you buy a business that is a turnaround, aka somebody else's problem, it's not profitable, the revenue's trending downwards, people are leaving the business, you're asking to grab a falling knife. I prefer to keep my hands intact. So that's one. Two is I look for businesses that have a long history of stable success. I actually don't want to see a growth chart like this. I don't want the hockey stick-like growth in most of my businesses. I want the business that has been around 3, 5, 10, 15 years, and kind of the revenue stays the same in some way, shape, or form. Because I think about buying businesses like bonds. So no matter what I do, I can't make one of my laundromats that does $300,000 a year make $30 million a year. It just doesn't work like that. And so I'm looking for a business that's a little bit more stable continuously.
Love that. And you've got kind of your deal box you talked about. Mm. So like you kind of know in general the industries that you're going to move into because you already know enough about them to ask smart questions and kind of know what kind of surprises might lie in store.
Yeah.
With flipping, we say there's always a surprise.
That's exactly right.
It can
right.
be early or it can be late. And I'm sure it's the same way with every business, right?
Yeah. We have this thing called a deal calculator and a deal box. And we were talking earlier, I think tools limit mistakes. So tools are the bumper lanes on your ability to make money instead of lose it. And so we're going to have at, where is it located?
We're going to go to theonething.com/Cody.
Yes.
And you can get that. And your future book, everybody who signs up will be the very first people to know about it.
Yeah, that comes out later this year. So if you guys want some tools to limit mistakes, grab this. Because I think the truth of the matter is, you know, when you go to buy a house, what do? You probably go look at the price online. You look at what our market comps, right? You see what it would be if you had an XYZ loan at X interest rate over this term. And now it's so normalized that there are calculators you can just plug all that into and go, okay, this house makes sense for me. That doesn't exist in small business buy-in land. But we've built a couple versions of it for you guys to play with. So you can get that if you go to that link.
In our industry, we pull comps. We go out and we try to pull comps that would be relatively close. Does that exist in the business buying or is it
No.
you're just buying it on this P&L and their track record?
Yeah, at bizscout.io in the future, we will have comps as a marketplace. Right now, imagine you could have a business that's geographically next door to each other, two laundromats, and one could be doing $100,000 in profit and one could be doing $25,000 in profit. One could actually be worth $1 million, one could be worth $25,000 because there's actually a bunch of debt and lawsuits on top of it. So the toughest part about small businesses is there's a lot of, in investing, we call it opaqueness. The more opaque the market, there's the more opportunity, but also the more ability for things to go sideways. And so it doesn't exist yet, but we are building it.
I love it. That goes back to your earlier statement. You want to have some sort of informational advantage.
Right.
Because you're working in an opaque industry. Mm-hmm. Information are the keys to the kingdom then.
Right.
Got it.
And you also always say, which I think is really important, that the business owner, you're always at a disadvantage. The business owner is always going to know more about that business. And the challenge in buying anything or really doing anything, building anything, is you don't know what you don't know,
yep.
Right? And so you have to be humble enough to ask the right questions, and you have to be comfortable in the not knowing. I mean, one of the things I've learned from Jay and Gary is that they will sit with a question until they complete, at Gary especially, sometimes so slow that we're like, come on. But he will sit with it as long as it takes for him to really internalize and understand it. And it's probably one of the best lessons that I've learned from both of you, that you're not worried about looking dumb, sounding dumb, and you certainly aren't feeling dumb because at the end of asking those right questions, you're probably smarter than the person who's explaining it to you. And they will be found out if they don't know what they're talking about. And I think we see that a lot in finance especially, where they're using a lot of really big words that they don't even understand themselves.
Oh, yeah. You know, if I had to see one trait that exists along all billionaires that I've met and hung out with, It's that they do not care what you think about them. They do not care. They have a lot of myriad other things, but they actually don't really care. And that is such a superpower because it means that past the point of socially comfortable, they will sit. Where most of us, if I was quiet here for a period and I didn't prompt them, what would they likely do? Jump in.
Yeah.
Right? What do we do when somebody asks like too many questions? We're kind of like, this is like, oh, I asked a lot of questions. I have some dialogue going on in my head. And I found that those people who have amassed a crazy amount of money, they don't care. And so all they care about is what is their goal and outcome. Now, they might like forward profess that they care, or they might like people liking them, but they'll never do it at the detriment of their decision making. If they did that, they wouldn't be a billionaire anymore. And so I think you're exactly right. Whether it's shutting up and letting somebody talk until they hang themselves with their own rope, whether it is asking more questions, simpler questions, and saying, explain it to me like I'm six because I don't understand anything about this at all. And realizing that you saying, you know, if I say to somebody, I don't know anything about this at all, treat me like a dumb idiot that's 6 years old, and then explain it to me. I don't think that I am a dumb idiot because I asked that question. I actually think I'm pretty smart. I just don't know anything about this thing. And it's this other person's job to fill me in. Now, if you're going to buy a business, you probably can't phrase it that way, but you could do it with a little bit more empathy and say something like, when I buy a business, what I'm sure you already realize is that you know way more about this thing than I will probably ever know, or at least than I will know for many, many years. And so because of that, I'm going to have to ask some really dumb questions. I'm going to have to ask for more than you're probably comfortable sharing. And the reason why is because could you imagine what would be awful for me is you know all of this stuff. You say this will all be true, but I don't know how to validate any of that. And so we're going to have to like really dive in a little bit in order for me to get comfortable that what is happening is truly happening. And it's not a you thing, it's a me thing. And then that kind, and then you say something like, is that okay with you? Does that sound reasonable with you? At which point they are, of course, going to say yes, because why? Because we're all people pleasers. And it's societally really hard to say no to something like that. If they were a pro, they might say, there's too many people looking at this deal right now. You get 60 days max. Here's the information provided. And please feel free to have it. And I will only answer questions within this constraint. That might be a pro. But most people will go, oh, yeah, of course. Of course you can text me. Of course you can call me. And so I think that's the difference between the two.
So many people, if they've had a family business, right? I mean, a lot of the boomers that are retiring, what is it, like 10,000 a day or something crazy? A lot of them are business owners.
Yeah.
And they have the curse of knowledge, right? They can't get back to the beginner's mind. They've been doing it so long in unconscious competence. They know how to make the dough for their pizzas. And it's not, I mean, like my great aunt June made these rolls that were amazing. We all have her handwritten recipe and nobody can make them. Nobody. It would be like a giant experiment because there's something that she does that she's not aware of and can't write down. So like, that's just a reality. So kind of a polite interrogation to get to know the business is huge. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard the story when Gary first started Keller Williams, he went into all the top real estate offices and just said, hey, I'm thinking about starting a real estate company. Can I just look around your office?
And they said, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because that's the kind of industry we're in, right? People are like, sure. And he'd say, do you mind if I take pictures? And they all said, no problem at all. And so he walked around, he counted how many phone lines they had. He took pictures of the parking lot, how many square feet, how many phone lines, and how many parking spots. And I remember this is like early 80s. But he just wanted to figure out, like, if I was going to run a real estate business, these are the top ones, like, and he goes, like, the funny thing is they all had all these parking spots and all these phone lines, but there were only ever two or three agents in the office.
Mm.
And so, like, his first competitive advantage was starting with, I think, less than, like, 1,200 square feet or something stupid. Like, as small as our first home, basically. But he also knew, it's like, none of the agents are going to be there at the same time. It's like a gem formula or something. But it's like, what's resonating for me is how much people will share if you just show up with curious, nod your head and say, man, that's amazing. What else? Yeah.
Well, and also the smart thing that Gary did that we didn't talk about is Gary didn't ask them how they run their business, how many lines do they have, you know, why do they do it that way? Because if he would have asked them, they would have validated their decisions because they obviously didn't realize that they don't want to, no business owner wants to spend money without need. So they would have said, well, you know, you really need to have 20, 25 lines. You got to have about 40 parking spots up front. You need a building that's about 5,000 square feet because that's what they have. But instead he said, can I just shadow you? Can you just show me? Instead of you telling me things, I want you to show me things. And anytime you can do that, you can see the disconnect between what we think as humans and what is real in actuality. And so that's why in business buying, we do walkthroughs.
That's
and
cool.
So, yes, yeah, so you need to walk through the business. You need to sit down and say, hey, can you show me how you file XYZ report? Hey, can I go on a ride along with your truck driver to see what that looks like? Because what you'll likely find is that their spoken reality has nothing to do with actual reality.
Well, I think this goes back to what we talked about earlier, which is how many deals you say no to. Mm-hmm. And in this process of asking questions, you get really smart about business. I mean, that's probably where some of your experience has been gained. It's been experience on other people's experience that you didn't even have to experience the pain that they experienced because you just asked the right questions.
Oh, yeah. Right? I mean, we have a community called Contrarian Community where every single Monday we do a deal review. We review business potentially for sale. How would we buy it? What do we like about this business? What does the P&L look like? And the reason we created that is when I first started creating education about buying and selling businesses, I was like, I'm really busy actually doing this. People keep asking me questions. Here's a course. And so people would go take the course. And I was like, that's cool. And then I realized, my God, what people actually need is they need 1,000 reps. But if you do 1,000 reps wrong in business buying, you're bankrupt. So how could we get people 1,000 reps so that they could actually know how to buy a business, feel comfortable, but learn on somebody else's time? Mm-hmm. And the way that we do that is these Monday deal reviews. So every single Monday, there's like 3 to 10 different deal reviews. And we go through, okay, I want to buy this laundromat. It is a real deal live. Here's what the owner has provided me. And then you have a bunch of people who are experts in like 15 different industries. And they basically go, ooh, that lease is high. Oh, I actually don't like the cost of the utilities over there. Can you go back and ask them these couple of questions? Then you can go back and watch this happen 100 times, and then you can bring your deal live. And then what happens is you haven't even done your first deal yet, but you've seen 50. So you know more than most private equity analysts because you've seen so many reps. And that's why I think it's really cool what you guys do at Keller Williams, because I basically realized people do not know how to buy businesses by and large. And the only way to teach them is not tell them, but show them. So that's what we do each week.
So case studies. And I mean, like, that's so smart. One, you're doing a case study as a group.
Yeah.
So you get the benefit of everyone's observations.
Yeah.
So you're also not just in terms of fake deal flow.
Right.
Every case study is a way for you to learn. But you're not just learning from yourself. You're learning from everyone else in the room.
Yep.
And then a lot of times they're saying, oh, I did that once and I lost $100,000. You get to learn from all of their mistakes.
100%.
That is such an underutilized method to get smart fast. And yeah. Just, you know, I salute that. That's awesome.
Well, I think it's so, we see this in our industry all the time that someone will say, I'm trying to build this type of business. And we'll say, a lot of people have done that before. You should go and ask them about it. And they'll be like, no. This is different. I am different. We're like, probably not. Like, you should just go and learn from these people. You will get to go much faster. Anything you want to do, build, have, create, somebody has probably preceded you. And it might not be exactly, but somebody's preceded you in that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, anytime I can steal somebody's 10,000 hours, I'm going to try to do it.
Yeah.
Because there is nothing more precious than your lifetime. It is the only thing that is absolutely finite, as opposed to money and success, completely not finite. And so anytime I can have tools limit mistakes, collapse timeframes, and turn decades into days, I'm going to do it. And that is what I've seen most of the most successful people in life do. And yet, what do most people in general do? Like, I always giggle. We make the cost of our community where we teach people to buy businesses. In my mind, you know, it's inexpensive in one way because the cost to go to like Wharton or Harvard is, I don't know, $150,000. But it's $10,000. And at first I remember being like, ooh, it's kind of expensive. Like, can everybody handle that? And then I realized that we had to have a barrier of entry for those who were really going to do the thing and those who are not going to do the thing. And if you can't afford $10,000 to the education of how to buy a business that's going to make you potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, or make you lose that same amount, you should not buy a business.
Yep.
And so where most people go sideways is they don't spend on the education, they spend on the pain. So they make a short-term decision because it feels good and you get an adrenal response to go and buy a business right away. And then later they go, fuck, I made all these mistakes. And instead they probably should have front-loaded the pain. They should have said, I want to spend 3, 6, or 12 months obsessively learning about this, because when then I make that decision, I have already had all the pain and I haven't had any of the pain monetarily yet. I've just spent on educating, because You know, I've never seen somebody lose money learning something. The risks are always in the implementation. Always. It sounds silly, but what's crazy is, like, that's the biggest thing people come to me. Well, I want to buy this business. It already exists. It's out there, but I don't want to spend money on learning how. I'm like, then don't buy a business, because you're probably not ready if you don't realize where all your risk is.
A lot of people get in there and someone approached them to buy the business.
Yeah.
And they have this, unlike you, you've got everybody like in the room to basically raise their hands, and you ask them, like, if you would sell your business today for the right price at the right time, mm-hmm. keep your hand up. And so, like, what, 80% of the room?
Yep.
Like, I think people underestimate how many businesses there are that they could buy. And so they get over-indexed on the one that's right in front of them.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's where that need, that drive to act, which is in our industry very strong. That's how they got to be salespeople. Yeah. They take action. Holding it back, even for a little while, you know, it's choose your hard, that whole trite thing.
Yeah.
Like, if you just go in without learning, those mistakes can be worth, can cost you 50 times what you're paying for your education.
Yeah.
Easy. One bad hire. I've already got one bad hire that's over $500,000.
Exactly.
That's like, so like, how can I prevent those kinds of mistakes with a small investment? That's invaluable.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, I think sometimes what happens in deals overall, and I'm sure you guys see it in real estate too, is, you know, imagine young you, like teenage you, and you've just realized sex is cool. Like, I like it. There's this thing called sex, and I like it. And you meet somebody, and you get to have sex with that person. And that's the only person that you've ever met and the only person that you've ever had sex with. And you go, perfect, I'll take it. That's probably not gonna happen or be very reasonable. And yet I think that happens sometimes with deals and businesses in particular. They go, oh, I just realized that I can do a deal. There is a deal in front of me. I shall do said deal. And I will commit myself for somewhere between 5 and 10 years, the average lifespan of a marriage as well. And so I really think that if we can get people to not only think that it's possible to do deals, to think that it's possible to buy a business, to own a business, and to become an owner in a world of squatters, and then that it is beneficial to spend upfront on the pain associated with learning with no reward for a period of time, and then finally to make the decision after they have had so many views, you know, they've Tinder swiped their way to realizing what a good business is, then they might be really happy at the outcome. And that's how I think about it.
You just got everybody who fell asleep to wake up again. So thank you. Thank you. So I want to, like, in the time we have left, I want to go down one specific path. Like, on our journey, we were starting with real estate. And in real estate, it's very easy, especially in the last 20 years, to grow your net worth, but not necessarily your cash flow.
Yeah.
And about, I don't know, 7 years into the journey, Wendy and I realized, like, we have to get into the business of owning businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Because income is what's gonna drive and pay for our future lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And so everybody on the path to wealth building, which is very much a part of our culture and the people who listen to this podcast, at some point you're gonna cross this threshold.
Yep.
Can we go back in time?
Mm-hmm.
What was the first business you bought and where did that come from? Was it like, are you telling us to get educated because that was a very expensive paid education? Or did you get lucky a few times and roll with it? Like, what's your origin story on buying businesses, if you don't mind?
Yeah, in investing, there's sort of a quote that goes, you never want to be somebody's first $500,000 in investing because you're only guaranteed of one thing, and that is to lose it all. And so I think that I've never met somebody who did deals and they haven't actually done a lot of at-bats for winning. And so in investing land, what does that look like? In finance, I don't lead my first deal ever. Like, you would never come into a finance, an investment management team, go, hi, my name's Cody. Okay, I think we should buy this business. You would sit on the sidelines as an analyst or investment associate for a while and you'd watch deal, 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 with the other people at the table being the ones that do it. And that's why we end up doing a good job and making a lot of money in investing, is because we get to see these other smart deal makers analyze businesses again and again and again. And then finally, we get to go, ooh, I see this one. It's a good deal. We bring it to the table. Other people beat up the deal. And then we eventually do the deal. That's how it works. That's how, like, every time you guys invest in a mutual fund or a REIT or whatever, that's the process. So I have just taken that process for Wall Street and recreated it because I think it's the best way to do it. My first two businesses that I bought, I lost money on because I was really early in finance. I did the first deal that I came across. One one was a consulting firm, like cross border. And like, I didn't lose much money, but a little bit. It wasn't, it was, I really bought a job. I didn't buy a business. Yeah. I did too small of a deal. I did a deal that actually was really service-based. There was no operations or processes in it. And I bought a type of business that was really a personality-driven business. Like this one guy drove the entire business. So I did the things.
So you counted at least four mistakes that you've learned from right there.
Yeah, we have a list of like 22 ways to royally F up a business. and I hit four of them. And so, and another one that I did on top of that, like people will say, like buy a business into your pain, get, you know, get profit from your pain. Have you guys ever heard that before?
Mm-hmm.
Dumb. So dumb. Don't do that. I bought a business. It was a fashion styling marketplace. And it turns out I don't really like fashion. I also hate stylists. That is a unique breed of people. And it was with a bunch of influencers in the fashion space. You can imagine how annoying those people were to work with. Like, they don't like to work. They want to take selfies. The whole thing was a night. So I didn't like fashion. I didn't really like selfie takers. And I thought I should buy this business because it was a pain point for me that I didn't want to pick out my own clothes. I find that annoying. And so that business was a fail. Then finally, I was like, wait a second. What do I actually want out of these businesses? I don't want something cool. I don't want something that is another job. I already have one of those. I was working at the time. I actually just want cash flow. And so then I started looking at the deals that we did in private equity a little bit closer. And I was like, I think what I really want is I want like a semi-absentee business that's really simple to understand, that's had a long history of success because I'm not sure I'm smart enough to pick one that's just on the up and coming. And so I started looking around for those. And then I realized one other thing. I don't want to operate the business because I don't have enough time right now to do that. So how can I find somebody who already has the inside access and knowledge on how to run this, who doesn't have the cash, because maybe I do. They could run the business for me, and it's a stupid, simple business that I would be an idiot if I couldn't understand. And so I landed on laundromats. And that was one of my very first deals that then sort of created this entire empire, basically.
That's awesome. I love that. I think I warned you about this when we were prepping. One of the things a lot of people, before they can step out of their business and start acquiring it, is they have to find the operator that can run their own business.
Mm-hmm.
You've bought all of these businesses. That's one thing. If you've got hacks, tricks, like how do you attract an operator to do the job part of the business so that you can be the owner?
I consider myself a collector of competency. And so everywhere I go, I am measuring how competent I think the humans are around me. It turns out we have a competency crisis. There are a bunch of people in this world who like to talk, don't actually like to do, and are incapable of doing. And so what I want you to do before I even tell you how to find an operator is, can you even tell what competent looks like? And it could be something very small, like you go to your country club, and the guy knows your name every time. He auto pulls out your car. He remembers the exact towel that you have each time if you golf. I don't know why I'm using this example. I neither golf nor country club, but just there we go.
Yeah.
And so you note in these humans that they're just slightly different. They put in that 10% extra effort. And so I collect those people. And I keep them in the back of my brain, and I think about them for different things that I have going on. For instance, you know, my cleaning lady, Laura, is incredible. And she would, like, do all these weird things. Like, she realized I like flowers, so she would get, like, flowers delivered. She would place them in little things all over the place. She'd water my plants. I hate when the plants die. She would leave a little, like, note about some of the stuff in the fridge that, you know, she thinks she should go, and should this throw away or not? And I thought, God, this woman's pretty diligent. And so what did I do? I had a small deal, a laundromat that I bought, and I put her in charge of running the laundromat. And so I use those low-level examples because even if you are right now in a business that doesn't do millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, you can collect competency all around you. And you can actually test them with small things like your cleaning or like the person who gets your clubs from the golf club. And so that's where I would start. And then I think
Can I just say competency feels like such a low bar? But it's where we are, isn't it?
It is where we are.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. It's where we are.
Okay.
And the second thing I would say is it's sort of incredible what happens when you start saying, I am an owner of businesses and I hire people to run my businesses. That's what I do. And so a lot of attraction is just proper external definition. And so do you actually define yourself as a person that is looking for other people to run their businesses and that allows other people to become CEOs due to the things that you own? And so I think a lot of the reasons why people can't find somebody is they've never even said it out loud.
Yeah.
You know, they've never even said, I am actually looking for a CEO for my real estate business right now. Maybe because it feels weird. You're like, the business only makes like $750 a year, you know, or $250 a year. Can I have a CEO for the business? And the answer is yes. I have a CEO of a laundromat. Her name's Laura. And so it can scale up no matter where you're at.
I'm going to add one thing and you'll jump in. I think a lot of people have got their lifestyle locked into the $750,000. Mm. But if they could live on $500,000, mm-hmm. imagine the talent they could attract for $250,000 to run a small business. Somebody who's running a giant department who hates corporate life would die to get into small business, would be all over that. And I think there's that gap between what we're willing to give up to get that. Sometimes it gets in the way.
Well, I think it's a Buffett quote, right? That people talk about his prowess in buying businesses, but it's not just that. It's his ability to hire the CEOs that run those businesses because he's not buying those to go and run them himself. He doesn't run any of those businesses. He doesn't touch them. He hires the right person to go and run them.
Yeah. Munger has an incredible quote, which is, you don't get a dog and then do the barking for it. And that's the same thing with operators. You know, you don't hire somebody to run your company and then do the operating for them. You trust them to do the thing. And you also, you trust but verify. So, you know, when I think about the type of people that I hire to run my companies, I want proven talent. So they're going to run a laundromat. Maybe they've already run a laundromat. I want known talent, aka I know this person, and if I don't know them, somebody else knows them quite well. They're highly referenced. And I try for those two things almost above anything else. Now, at this stage of the game, I can kind of tell who will be good at something. But in the beginning, when I hired my first laundromat operator, it was like, he's already run laundromats, and I know the guy, and I know the devil that I'm getting. And so that's where I would start. Where people get into trouble is they go, this guy was in the military for 15 years. He knows how to run a business. He's super hierarchical. I don't know if he could run a real estate company, but I bet he could because it translates. The first time you do any of this stuff, just make it so simple that it's almost criminal. Like, we humans, I think, like to make things more complicated so we can fix those problems, like we were talking about before.
Well, it's also a great excuse.
Verify, just because that's an important, you said trust, but verify kind of thing.
Yeah.
What does verify look like with these people? Are you just putting a couple of KPIs in front of them and checking in on a regular basis? Because that's where a lot of people get lazy too.
Oh.
They set a standard that they never go back to inspect it.
If you remember anything, remember front-load pain leads to long-term profit. Short-term pain, long-term profit. So every time you want to make a rapid decision because it seems easier up front, you're probably in for long-term pain and or loss of money.
Yep.
And so what you should be doing is spending most of your pain up front so that you never have to worry about it again. So for instance, we just hired a CEO for the company BizScout, and I must have interviewed 40 people for that job. I also hired a recruiting firm because I didn't think that I could get the level of talent that I wanted. Every single candidate that was in the last 10 candidates that we were going to hire, I had my senior team, so that's 4 to 5 people, speak to each one of those candidates. We have what's called the hiring matrix, basically 5 different things that have numbers associated with them, where if they have those items, they can get max up to a 5 and the lowest a 0. And everybody takes notes and reads out to the team on what they think about each candidate. That might sound a little bit crazy, but that entire process probably took 65, 70 days, something like that. So 2 months. 2 months for a business that I think could be a $1 billion business that I'm probably going to run for 10 years. That actually seems like maybe not enough time. And so I really think about front-loading the pain.
I love that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think this is so important too, because I think so often when we are hiring in isolation, we end up hiring people that we like, that are like us, which is always a mistake. You know what my business doesn't need? Another me. Nope. Like, it absolutely does not need more me.
Yeah.
So when I'm hiring, I have to find someone to fill the gaps that I cannot fill. And part of you bringing your team into it not only ensures collaboration, but also allows them to make sure that you're not hiring another you, which we tend to do as business owners.
Yeah. Best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. So another easy way to determine if somebody's going to be a good hire, partner, client, friend is how do they treat their former clients, partners, friends? You really want to find people with a track record of winning. And so the time that I've made mistakes is, you know, I look back on it. I'm like, God, you're such an idiot. He talked to you immediately about like a bad partner that he had previously, a bad investor that he had previously. He lived in like a tiny little apartment, even though he was 42 years old, which means he hadn't had material success yet. He was kind of telling you all the excuses and reasons why something didn't work, but really liked the fucker. You know, it makes no sense.
Seems like a cool dude.
Makes no sense. And yet that we are predisposed to hire those that are like us and that we like. And so I try to make sure that I have parameters in place where me liking them is almost irrelevant. I'm not looking for more friends at this stage. I'm looking for more profits. And I try to not mix the two.
All right, we're getting to the end. Do we have any rapid fire questions or anything we want to wrap up with?
Well, there's only one question that we ever wrap up with. We didn't prep you for it, so we're going to put you on the spot. At the end of this podcast, we always ask, what's the one thing? If somebody's listening to this, what's the one thing that you would want them to take out of this conversation that you would want to be able to impart on them?
We've talked a lot about you guys making money, and I think that's great. But what's better than that is that I think that if humans like you continue to live small lives, working for other people, not owning anything, this country gets a lot worse than it already is today. And I don't think that anybody in here thinks that we are on a trajectory that is incredible. And so my appeal to all of you is not actually something I want to leave you with. It's something I want from all of you. It's that it's not just that you can live an incredible life, that you can achieve far more than you think you're capable of, that you can have massive success. It's that if you don't, everybody around you gets a little bit worse. And that we need every single human we can to come on the side of builders, not burn it downers, to come on the side of owners and not squatters. And there are not enough of you. Just spend 5 minutes on any Instagram channel and look at the comments and see people who want and think they deserve things as opposed to that they are able to earn things. And so my push for all of you, the one thing is, if you do not die with ownership, if you die as the average person dies in the US, you will die alone, fat, and broke. Those are just the numbers. Being average is not sufficient in this world today. And so I hope that I imprint upon you that it is possible, but it is also imperative that you get some skin in the game.
Well, if one group of people can get behind... If one industry can get behind ownership, it's got to be real estate. All right. Love that. I love what you stand for. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your talents with us. This has been amazing.
If people want to find you, where can they go?
Cody Sanchez on all the channels and contrarianthinking.co if you guys want to learn about small business buying.
And if y'all want to be on her list for the book, you're going to go to thenumberonething.com/Cody, C-O-D-I-E.
Awesome. Right. Thank you, guys.
Thank y'all.
Thanks for listening to the One Thing Podcast. If you're a bold risk taker who wants to dream big and achieve a higher level of success in your life or business, visit theonething.com. There you'll find information on one-on-one coaching, our exclusive community membership program, and customized workshops that will help you get your team or organization aligned and rowing in the same direction. That's the1.com to start living the life you've always dreamed of today. Be sure to follow the show to stay up to date on weekly episodes, guest interviews, and more. Plus, we would love to hear from you. Send us a voice note by going to speakpipe.com/theonething or email us at podcast@theonething.com. We'll see you next week.